Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. And with me today is MSNBC contributor and former, like me, former Catholic altar boy, Kurt Bardella, who's also worked with a former Congressman, Daryl Issa, who was on a board with me, Lebanese-American Society.
Oh, sure.
A long time ago. I hosted an event where they told me, whatever you do, don't make jokes because he'll get upset. So I said, I said, what's the difference between a Republican and a Democrat? And they said, what? And I said, well, Democrat will pick your pocket, but the Republican will just take your pants.
And he laughed. That joke.
Pardon?
I think he'd like that joke.
Yeah, he did. He laughed. That put everybody at ease, and then we took their money. Anyway,
well done.
So Kurt's with us, and we'll be back right after this break. Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Like I said, with me is Kurt Bardella, who's also, you can see him on MSNBC with Morning Joe and journalist. And I have to add, at some point in time, we got to talk about that country music thing.
Oh, yeah. That's,
as
morning you hangover. Morning hang. I'll tell you, on July 5th, I did my Morning Joe hit from a bar in Nashville, a bunch of booze behind me. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
What attracted you to country music?
You know, it had to have been around 2010, or a friend of mine just had an extra ticket to a show at the amphitheater up the road from me in Virginia. And I went, yeah, sure, I'll go to any live music type of thing, right? Yeah. And I just had a blast. I had so much fun. Started going to shows that summer and just became this really, really big fan. And much to my shock, I had this idea for a daily morning email about country music, kind of like how in our world we have reliable sources and a playbook and Axios. And I thought, man, it'd be really cool if something like that existed for country music. And I just started doing it as a hobby, just for fun, in 2016, because the world was awful and I needed something to take my mind off of this place. And it just caught on in Nashville and Music Row. The entire industry started reading it. Wow. Soon the label started sponsoring it every week. And and I started getting invited to all these shows and events and getting to meet all these artists and become friends with a lot of them. And it's been, of all the things that I missed during the COVID lockdown, going to live music is the top of that list. I probably went to 60, 70 shows in 2019 and go from that to nothing was just horrible. And so
I agree. I play in a band and it's tough, but I country music, I've always liked bluegrass. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, so little Lebanese boy growing up in Louisville, I was rock and roll and southern rock, but the commercial country was not my thing. But I still listen to bluegrass. I love that. And yeah, going to bluegrass festivals. And if you are ever in the mood to go out and see some rock and roll, I invite you to come see my band.
Okay, we're gonna make that happen.
Yeah. So let's get to the point at hand. I guess in just asking the question, we've both gone through, 4 years of Donald Trump. And I guess the question at this point is, do you think we live in a dystopia?
You know, we're not there yet, but I think that we are so much closer than most people either want to admit or even realize. For so long, I've observed that there's been too many people within the Republican Party who treated Trump as if it was a temporary anomaly that would go away if he went away, which of course we know has turned out to be completely untrue, right? And I think there are so many in the Democratic Party who felt that by dispatching Trump, things would, quote, go back to normal, when in reality, things have gotten actually much worse. I mean, if you were to poll people in the political media community and ask them the question, will things get better or worse after Donald Trump loses in November of 2020? Almost everybody would have said, oh, it'll get better universally. And and the sad reality is our politics have actually gotten worse. And the Republican Party has gotten even more extreme, which I don't think anybody even imagined that would be possible. I certainly was in that camp. Like, how much worse could it get? Like, at some point you hit the bottom.
Well, they've clawed through the bottom and are in the basement now with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert. I mean, I watched her, you know, prancing around in CPAC like a fascist cheerleader.
When you look at what CPAC is now and compare it to when Mitt Romney was the Republican standard bearer for the Republican Party, I mean, it's unrecognizable. I mean, it's not in the galaxy in terms of just what the conversation is about, what the issues are, what animates the people that are there. I mean, this is a place that literally gave Mitt Romney a standing ovation at one point in time.
Right, right. Yeah. I was there. And I look at it, and it's not just CPAC, but it's everything. You know, I interviewed Michael Cohen recently and Joe Walsh, and both of them said that they think the Republican Party doesn't even exist anymore, and that it will disintegrate into a strong regional party, but not a national party. I don't know if I'm convinced of that. I think there's some danger in this, in the Republican Party. And as you said, I don't think people are aware of it. And I am in the White House every day, and I can guarantee you that this White House I don't know if they're not aware of it. I know they don't project the image that they're aware of it.
Right. I mean, I think that a little bit of that is, you almost don't want to breathe more life into something this horrible because it might perpetuate it and make it so, right? You know, it's like self-fulfilling prophecy. I would like to think, and I know a lot of people in the White House who, if there's one thing that I think probably keeps some of those people up at night, it's the destructive politics that we are in right now that have brought us to the precipice of, I'm not going to say outright civil war, but the fact that there is a group of people in this country that is actively agitating for violence to achieve their political means is the most dangerous thing that we have experienced in America since the actual civil war.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that. That takes me to the big lie. Megyn Kelly saying, look, it was overplayed, that the insurrection on January 6th wasn't that big a deal. I've heard it was either a hoax, it was an FBI undercover job, it was Antifa, it was just people visiting and they were friendly. And when you talk to Trumpers, they're willing and able to believe all four of those scenarios at the same time, which is to say is Orwellian, is like to say that water is wet. I mean, they're willing to believe this. Sight unseen. And look, I was there. I was threatened. I remember watching the guys crawl the wall like Spider-Man. And I said, hey, idiots, there's steps at either side. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to break their neck. And they did. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. But it was violent. It was dangerous. And if we don't prosecute those people, there is the fear that this will perpetuate itself and be worse the next time around.
I've been so vocal in the need to actually have a January 6th investigation done at the congressional level, because if you aren't willing to uncover and expose everybody who played a role in helping that happen, you are giving them permission to do it again. And to your point, if we do not prosecute to the fullest extent of the law, the people who are part of what I believe to be an act of domestic terrorism on American soil, if you don't do that, you're saying it's okay. You are condoning right. by doing nothing.
What do you think will happen?
Not enough. I think that when I think about the select committee that's just been formed, you know, people that need to be brought under oath to testify are people like Kevin McCarthy, Mike Pence, people who were there, who lived it, who have real-time information about how the levers of power were activated or ignored to try to intervene during a riot. And I don't think that those people, even if they were subpoenaed, would show up. I think that they would say, screw you guys. We're going to do what we want. We're not going to answer questions. And there's nothing you can do about that, because the lesson that they learned during the last 4 years is that if you don't like the question, if you don't like what's being done, just ignore it, flaunt it. There are no checks and balances. The most dangerous thing that happened over the last 4 years during the Trump presidency was the complete erosion of checks and balances when we talk about the institutional things that were harmed during the Trump years. And watching time and again, Congress issue subpoenas, have them ignored, and then nothing happened because of that is, you know, was mind-blowing to me as someone who worked at the Oversight Committee when Daryl Issa was chairman, who issued more than 100 subpoenas to the Barack Obama administration, who started the investigations that led to things like the Benghazi committee that resulted in Hillary Clinton testifying for, you know, 11, 13 hours
right.
During an election year. Hearing everyday Republicans on that committee, like Jim Jordan, like Mark Meadows, like Mike Pompeo, talk about, well, the only path to the truth is through the House of Representatives, holding the Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress for not cooperating with an investigation. Watching those people completely ignore all of those things to let Donald Trump and his administration run roughshod over checks and balances, it was like an alternate reality to watch that unfold.
Well, it's hypocrisy at its finest, or at its worst, depending on what. So that takes me back to the first question again. If, and not the country music question, but but if we're talking about dystopia, if we're not, and I would say if you step back, you could almost say we are a dystopia, because you look at people living in boxes underneath, you know, overpasses in DC, LA, the largest cities. It's like they're like, you know, extras from a Mad Max movie. Plus, you have people storming the Capitol, which wasn't even done during the Civil War. Right. And you look at it, and one could make a pretty good argument for the dystopia currently. But if not enough is done, if we do not rely or regain our checks and balances, then it seems to me that if we're not at a dystopia, man, we're, like you said, we're close. And I don't think there's any way to stop us from becoming one.
Yeah, I think that when I look at particularly the systemic effort to influence who can even participate in our democratic process, that is the march to dystopia, because the nightmare scenario, it isn't January 6th per se, it's that Republicans effectively rigged the election before it can happen by undermining who can participate in it, thereby ensuring that they will always win. And I don't know what happens when they declare themselves the winner and everybody else says, well, that's total nonsense for a myriad of legitimate reasons. And you have the lack of confidence in the integrity of our elections then from both sides. Republicans refuse to accept election realities right now, but Democrats will have an absolute substantive argument to make that the elections that happen going forward in states that have limited who can participate, have purged voter rolls, have limited the window in which elections are even happening and when ballots are conducted, like that's a legitimate reason to question the integrity of an election when those things are happening.
Right.
And these things are being codified into law by Republican state legislators right now. And so when both sides ultimately lose confidence in the system, what are we then? Because we're not a functioning democracy anymore.
Well, I would say that's anarchy, and yeah, that's dystopia.
Yeah.
Are we headed towards anarchy in 2022?
That depends, I think, on what can be done right now to combat some of these voter suppression efforts that Republicans are engaging in. And I look at what's happened right now in Texas as a great example of, here is the Democratic Party standing up to that by making sure that it doesn't happen. What we do at a national level with the voting reform and the John Lewis Act and all of that is going to, I think, inform whether or not we are able to stave off reaching that dystopian model, or if we're able to kind of like, this is going to be our stand and we're going to fight it back before it overruns us.
Do you have confidence or hope that we can, or are you of the opinion that we are headed towards dystopia without the ability to change course?
You know, the one thing that always gives me optimism, and I'm not by nature an optimistic guy when it comes to politics, I'm pretty jaded at this point. But the one thing that continually gives me optimism is the Republican Party has, for reasons that I don't even understand, decided to double down on an orthodoxy that is incapable of growing in numbers. They are not a party that's going to grow. The demographics are against them in this country. The population overall is moving towards a specific direction that is away from them. When you think about it in the big picture in that way, it is inevitable that Republicans will eventually find themselves out of power. This is why they're doing all things they're doing now. They know that too. They know when the playing field is actually level, they can't win. The Republicans haven't won a popular vote in this country since 2004. And before that, they only had won it one time, and that was in 1988. So there is a number of indicators and metrics that tell you in the big picture, the Republican Party is pretty much screwed.
Is there that anyone, gives me optimism. That makes you optimistic. Republicans are screwed. As a former Republican and a former altar boy, so here's that question. Is there anyone in the Republican Party today deserving of respect at the national level? Who?
Yes. I think that Mitt Romney is. I think that Adam Kinzinger is. I think that...
They're disparaged by the rest of the Republicans.
Oh, they're despised. They are censured. They are, I think of people like Jeff Flake, even out of Arizona. I think of Cindy McCain as well, who was...
He left.
But again, this is the thing, you mentioned earlier, someone had said that the Republican Party is effectively dead, and it is. The Republican Party is a Republican in name only party. They are using that moniker, but nothing about what they actually stand for, talk about, fight for, has anything to do with traditional Republican and or conservative values.
And what are those values that they should stand for that they do not?
The most fundamental tenet of Republicanism is really about the role of government in our lives. Republicans are the ones that talk about having a limited government that has a limited amount of power and influence over the people that they serve. When you look at what the Republican Party stands for today, it is actually the complete opposite of that. It's the Republican Party that wants to tell you whether you can even vote or not. It's Republican Party that wants to tell you whether or not your business should be able to act a certain way or face a consequence. When for all the conversation about cancel culture, Republicans are actually now the biggest offenders of cancel culture.
Yes, absolutely.
They are for using the instruments of government to penalize people and go after private enterprises that they just don't agree with, which is one of the most anti-Republican things. Imagine if Barack Obama had said, I'm going to use my Justice Department to target company A, B, or C because I don't like them. They would have lost their damn mind. Imagine if.
Well, one can argue they have lost their damn mind.
They sure as hell have. But it's like, I watch the things that Republicans are fighting for and advocating for and say, this.
I don't know what they're fighting for. I only know what they're fighting against. Right. I don't know. And correct me if I'm wrong, because, look, I've often said, we have a problem in this country with the two-party system. We have one party that is a party of no heart, and one is a party of no head. And and you can, the Democrats managed to stumble over a very low bar set by Donald Trump, but it doesn't give me any confidence that they're going to be able to elevate the country to where it should be. And for all of those who want to get pissed at me, I don't care. I really don't. But the point is at least when it comes to a Democrat, when I sit down and talk to a member of the Democratic Party, I feel like I'm talking to someone who has an idea of where they want government to go, will make a proposal, will adhere to social norms and rules. I don't get that from the Republicans at all. It's my way or the highway. It's like dealing with a school bully, which is what Donald Trump was. And they have taken his ideas and made them their own.
I mean, it's ironic because, and I think that bully analogy is so right. And you know, I've always said, I wish if I could go back to a specific place and time in the last 5 years, it would be the first presidential primary debate when Trump pretty much annihilated, you know, Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
And you know, low energy Jeb and Lil Marco and lying Ted Cruz. And if any one of them had actually had the intestinal fortitude to just walk up to Donald Trump and slap him across the face, it'd be over for Trump. Like that'd be game over, because that's what you do with bully.
It's exactly right. That's what I tried to do in the White House, was just stand up to him as he tried to push, because that's, you know, my dad, you know, and a good Catholic father that he was, said the only way to deal with a bully was to thump him one. And, you know, I'm not going to punch Donald Trump.
I mean, I can tell you, if someone said on a national stage the things that Donald Trump said about Ted Cruz's wife and father, if that were my family, I would have walked up to him and just knocked him out, just based on that alone.
Yeah. I mean, and he would have had every right to do so.
And I guarantee you, Trump's facade of macho, tough guy, stronger than you, would fall like a house of cards. But no one did that. Everybody cowered in fear and spent the next 4 years worrying about, what if he calls me a name on Twitter? I'm like, are you freaking, where the hell, where are your balls? Are you kidding
me? Well, they put him in a blind trust.
You know? Apparently.
Somebody said to me, "Aren't you upset because Donald Trump called you names?" I go, "Hell, I've been called worse by people who love me."
Yeah.
Who gives a shit? I really don't. Listen, we're going
to. That was allowed to spread off of this nonsense, I don't understand, because I'm just not wired that way.
I'm not wired that way either.
Like, if someone wants a confrontation, like, okay, I'll get your grill. Just, I have no problem with that.
I absolutely have no problem.
And I feel like that's how you deal with people like Donald Trump, or people like Matt Gaetz, or people like Lauren Boebert. Like, they're all bullies cut from the same cloth to a certain degree.
Yeah, just stand up to them, and they don't, you know, we'll talk a little bit more of that on the other side of this first break. We've got Kurt Bardella with us, and he's talking about punching out Donald Trump. Well, so hang around. We'll be right back.
Just ask the question. Facts you can hear. Hey, JATQ podcast listeners. As you know, now more than ever, the truth is hard to come by. Misinformation and bias seem to be almost everywhere. But don't let those fearmongers get you down. Just ask the questions and help support a vital pillar of democracy by subscribing to our brand new Patreon page. We are independent, fact-oriented, and never partisan. Help us keep bringing you the objective news you need at patreon.com/JATQ podcast. That's patreon.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, it's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Kerriman, with this Kurt Bardella. Kurt was just talking about punching out Trump, which is, I got to tell you, very funny. But I want to go back to something we were talking about with Republicans and Democrats. And I was talking to Eric Swalwell recently, and he said he was in a bathroom one day and ran into Ted Cruz, and Ted Cruz said, "Hey, you're doing a great job. Way to go. Way to get in there and do what you got to do." And he said, "Brian, it occurred to me that they don't look at their people that they serve as their constituents, but rather as their fans, and they're playing to a fan base, and it's all performance art." The danger with that, of course, is that we don't get stuff done in politics, because politics isn't supposed to be performance art, supposed to be performance. Do you see the Republicans that way, or is it different?
Yeah, here's the thing. the audience doesn't know its performance. The politicians do. And that's the problem. I've always said that the Republican Party today, so much of it reminds me of WWE.
Thank you. I've said that too. That
you have these characters that every day wake up and they walk out to the ring and just, you know, talk trash, for lack of a better term, say they're going to do X, Y, and Z, beat up somebody, all that, right? And get the roar of the applause. CPAC might as well have been WrestleMania, you know.
For these guys. I mean, when I watched Lauren Boebert, that's exactly what it reminded me of. And there are people who believe that, you know, WWE is real. And a lot of those people.
I'll tell you something. WWE is a lot more real than Republican Party is right now. My God. You know, at least some of these folks who, you know, truly do live their gimmick. You know, the most successful, I've always said, the most successful personalities in politics, entertainment, music, are the people who are truly themselves. And they just turn it up a few notches when the camera is on.
Right.
Stone Cold Steve Austin is Stone Cold Steve Austin 24/7. That's not an act. He really is a redneck, hillbilly, beer-swilling, foul-mouthed guy from nowhere, Texas. Dwayne The Rock Johnson really is the most electrifying man in all of entertainment. He is charismatic. He is larger than life. That's real. The problem for Republicans is the only person who actually lives his gimmick, per se, is Donald Trump. Like, what you see is, he is consistently who he is all the time. Ted Cruz is pretending. Kevin McCarthy is pretending. All these other people that we see day in and day out, the ones who would give Eric Swalwell a pat on the back, they are pretending to be something that they are not for the fans, AKA the voters.
The constituents.
The difference between WWE and politics, however, is in WWE, the fan in the crowd isn't going to turn to the guy next to him and hit him with a steel chair. In politics now, the guy next to you could very well show up to your United States Capitol and storm it with violent intention.
Yeah, and they did. So let's talk a little bit about that, although I will say that before we close on that issue, that I have often thought that Matt Gaetz, Jim Jordan, and a lot of Ted Cruz, those that are acting, I look at them and they remind me of the kids in grade school that were always picked last for kickball.
Oh my God. You want to bet how many times Ted Cruz was swirly growing up and freaking cool? This guy has trash can written all over him.
That's there's a mental image that will soon not leave my head.
You know what? He probably deserved it too.
Yeah, that's he. I'm sure Matt Gaetz lost a few pairs of underwear to swirlies.
He has some wedgies, let me tell you.
Yeah. Wedgies, swirlies, and or as we called them when we were kids, undie grundies. But but now I've lost my thought. Oh,
who's in charge of this podcast? What's happening now?
Moving forward, let's talk about the big lie in the insurrection. This is a dangerous, it seems exceedingly dangerous that this continues and Trump continues his march into insurrection. What do you think the end game is for this? I know, and I want to keep this separate from does he run for office, but let's just talk about the end game for the insurrection. What do you think that will be?
Here's the ironic thing. The whole big lie, it's just his excuse for why he lost. It's like, this guy is so fragile emotionally, he can't fathom losing to anybody, especially Joe Biden.
Sleepy Joe.
So he manufactures this cover story so that he can sleep at night, not even thinking about anybody else or caring about anybody else.
You know, everything, I don't think he ever cares about anybody else or thinks about anyone else. I think it's just anyway.
Like, everything about Donald Trump comes down to Donald Trump.
Yes.
From that, somehow, a movement is born out of this insane cover story to make up and compensate for a man's fragile ego. People latch onto this story. And I think that their motivations are very different than Donald Trump's. Donald Trump's motivation is just to be able to sleep at night and feel like he's a winner, because He's a small dick, addle-minded dumbass. The other people.
Tell us what you really think.
And that's the sanitized version of that, obviously.
You can be as unsanitized as you want here.
The other part of this, though, the people who are using this and fueling it, the people at Fox News, the people in conservative media, so-called conservative media, the people like Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene or Kevin McCarthy or Chip Roy or whoever, they are using this for the sole purpose of clinging to power. They see it as an ends to a means for them to get the outcome in the election that they want, because they know there's no other way for them to win other than this right now.
Well, and what's frightening about it is, as they call and scream hoax in the election and voter fraud, none of them are contending that their victory should be looked at, though they were on the same ballot.
I mean, talk about cognitive dissonance. It's like, if the election was, so you're telling me that this great conspiracy came into play, and in doing so, they decided that, well, we're going to make sure that Joe Biden wins, but all the other Republicans who won, they can stay. Like, yeah. What the hell kind of conspiracy would that be?
Yeah, we like Lauren Boebert. Let's make sure she wins.
I mean, at the very least, you think they would have used this conspiracy to get rid of some people like Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz or Kevin McCarthy or some of the awful, horrible. What it's like? No, all of you seem to think that your election was legitimate. It's just the one election that you lost.
Right. And they can't explain that. There's no factual basis for this at all. And the frightening part was there were Republicans and Democrats. And I mean, I've worked on elections and have, you know, interviewed people who work those elections. Those people put in a lot of hours and they work together and they're neighbors. And some are Republicans, some are Democrats, some are independents. But when they sit there in that room, they care more about the process and they care more about the integrity of the election than these people who are screaming and ranting and raving about it. And frightening.
I mean, the people who work, you know, and actually do the work of showing up to the polls and putting in, like, it's something that it's a tradition for them. It is people who, honest to God, feel a sense of civic duty and are participating in our process in a way that makes them feel proud. It makes them feel involved, and has nothing to do with partisanship or who's going to win or who's going to lose. It's just something that they do, and to pay our democracy forward. I've always thought that those are the people when I go and vote and see the folks who are checking people in or the one who's giving you the sticker when you walk. It's like, those are the real, like,
yeah,
that's of democracy.
Yeah, and it is. Let's skip forward to 2022 and 2024. 2022, do you think the Republicans win back either the House or the Senate?
I don't. And I know I'm in the minority of those who think that. And I should disclose, I'm a consultant for the DCCC for this cycle.
Okay.
All about that. All about the one anyone say, how come he didn't say that? I think that, number one, anybody sitting here today who says the election's going to be about A, B, or C has no freaking idea what they're talking about. Because I can sit here with all certainty, I couldn't tell you what we're going to be talking about come June, July of 2022. Okay.
No one predicted Trump in 2016. So right. That's, yeah.
And, but what I do know is, God willing, the electorate will be in a better frame of mind in 2022 than they were last year when they were locked up in their homes dealing with the pandemic that killed 500,000 Americans. Hopefully we will not be in that situation again. So on the fundamental level of, is your life better today than it was before? The answer for most Americans will be yes. And I've always thought that is always the fundamental litmus test of an election and of the mood of the electorate is that basic question. And when you look at things like the overall economy will certainly be doing better, people have more jobs, people have more wages, the policies that the president, this administration have enacted are putting more money in people's pockets, particularly people who are making less than $100,000 a year in this country. A lot of things are gonna be happening that are gonna be happening right. And there will be less noise versus what we dealt with the last 4 years of every day, a Twitter barrage, something crazy and insane. People will be out of the house, living their lives, concerned about the future, but the future will at least look a lot better than it did in 2020. That alone makes me think that Democrats have a better chance than people are giving them credit for. People who handicap these things look at what the world looks
like.
Even
with voter suppression efforts in several states?
Oh, hey, that's an uphill battle between gerrymandering and voter suppression. Like, hey, this thing could be over before it begins. That's entirely possible just by those mechanisms. However, I do think that the fundamental problem for the Republican Party, and I think it could be a fatal problem, and it's something you said earlier, when you talk to Republicans, I don't know what they're fighting for.
Yeah.
I don't think
Mitch McConnell's ever even proposed legislation. Right. I'm just a roadblock standing here, and people get tired of that after a while. It's taken a long while, but
you can only go so long being against everything and for nothing before it catches up to you politically. And I think that the Republican credit on that brand of politics is running out.
So then let's skip forward to 2024. Do you believe that Donald Trump will run again?
Yes.
You do?
Assuming he's alive?
And assuming I don't know if he's alive now, but that's a different issue.
Assuming he's alive and not in jail, yes, I do.
I think he'd run if he were alive and in jail. But I also think it could be a Weekend at Bernie's thing where they'll just come out with a string and move his hand up and down. But I think it's a grift. I think everything the guy does is a grift. And I think he might talk himself into running because he sees it. You know, he loves going out like a tent revivalist. I often compare him to, you know, the old road shows for religion when they would show up in the South, you know, and tent revival and hoop and holler and speak in tongues.
He'll run and raise $1 billion. And that's really all he cares about.
Yeah, well, he's going to need it. I think that now, do you think he will face indictments?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah, I Absolutely. Do too. I think that's goes without. Well, we.
And it's because it's not that they commit crimes. It's how brazenly stupid they all are in effectuating those crimes that I have no doubt that when you have buffoons like Rudy Giuliani running around, like, yeah, they're going to get indicted.
Yeah, well, look, there's no shortage of idiots in Donald Trump's circle. I mean, it was got to be ridiculous on a daily basis walking into that White House, and they did not even understand. And I'll tell you a very quick story about someone who shall remain nameless, Hogan Gately. John Bennett and I, who was with The Hill at the time, we walked in to ask him about using the Posse Comitatus Act because Trump was talking about sending troops to the border. And so Republicans are well-versed in the Posse Comitatus Act because they're the ones who often, you know, talk about it. You know, yeah. You can't send troops down there without the posse. So they go and they get, you know, a permission from Congress to send troops. And we walk down to ask, and this member of Trump's team, Hogan Gridley, said, I said, you know, are you going to use the Posse Comitatus? And he goes, is that like a rule or is that like, what is that? And I go, what's a federal law passed in the 1880s or 90s? And you've got to go and get permission from Congress. And so we talked about a few other things. And then as we left, Bennett reiterated, are you going to get back to us on that? And he goes, yeah, I'll get back to you about that Hakuna Matata thing. And we left and he goes, really? Hakuna Matata, the Lion King? he's quoting Disney. Was completely unaware of what Posse Comitatus Act was. And that's a microcosm of the problem we had in there every day. They did not understand federal law, nor did they really care. And right. I think you can see that in the latest lawsuit that Trump is bringing against, you know, social media, not understanding the different, you know, what First Amendment free speech is. It's when the government interferes with your speech, not when, you know, a company does. But that's, I don't think he gets it.
They don't. And the lack of just core competencies is going to be their death nail.
The scary part is, Kurt, I mean, there are millions of people who buy this.
Oh, yeah.
How do you get them brought up to reality? Because you're not going to get Trump. Trump is never going to change. As you said earlier, Trump is Trump. He's genuine. He's a genuine narcissistic, addle-minded, autocratic, bureaucratic, fascist, egotistical cocksucker. And you're never going to get that to change. But I have hope that there are people who will learn and change. How do you do that? And that's the last thought we'll have before we go into break. Your answer to that one.
Well, I think that, again, the first thing you have to do is try to get some of the noise to stop. I don't think that people can move beyond this moment in time until Trump has been actually dispensed with in a definitive way. He, you know, the fact that he lost in 2020, but he always was available to run in 2024. Like, that was always going to be, you know, that door was open for him. If he runs and loses in 2024, hey, that's it. Like, there's nothing left for him to run for at that point. He can't run again. He'll be just too freaking old.
But
like, he'll really be like, that would put him in, you know, 8 years from now. It's like, it's just not going to happen. And so it's until that door is definitively closed for both him and the Republican Party, like, everything is frozen right now in the Republican Party. Nothing is changing. Nothing is evolving. Nothing is moving beyond, because Trump is still king of the party. Until the king is gone, there's not going to be any movement, any changing, any recalibration at all.
Yeah, but if Trump is gone, does Trumpism evaporate, or does it transmute, or does someone take, you know, like DeSantis take the helm as the new king?
Someone will try to take the mantle, but the thing is, they're going to be an imitation. They're going to be a knockoff, and it never is what it could be when you have that situation. Ron DeSantis is a political creature who came up in the political world. He was a member of the House of Representatives. He's an elected official. His entire DNA is completely different than Donald Trump's in just about every way.
Well, brother, I think the DNA of most people is entirely different from Donald Trump's in many ways. But
that's probably true. Most of it probably isn't made of Cheese Whiz. So you got
or hamburgers.
but I think that people can try to pretend to be the next incarnation of Donald Trump, but no one's ever going to be. He is a very unique figure all to himself. I mean, even before he was in politics, he was a very distinct and unique and non-duplicative. You know, you can't make another one. You can't just pump one out of a factory. Like, who Donald Trump is from decades and decades of experience and, you know, cultivating an image and, you know, dealing with the media and coming up in tabloid world and all that. Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, all of these people, traditional politicians who came up and know nothing other than serving in public office, who know nothing other than what it's like to have your schedule and life revolve around the congressional calendar. They are not going to ever be able to be what Donald Trump was.
But what I think Donald Trump has done is exposed the vacuousness of many of our elected officials and how they are willing to cling to power in any way possible,
right,
even subverting the good of the nation for the good of themselves. That's right. What's frightening. And I don't think that ends when I think if Trump ends, that portion of Trump, that portion of Trumpism, I think is with us for a while. We've got to get rid of gerrymandering. We have to educate people a little bit better. And God, you know, and this is on us. I think our profession needs to improve itself quite a bit in order to make sure that some of the more caustic portions of Trumpism cease to exist. But
yeah,
that's a thought we'll take going into the break. We'll take another break. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. And hey, it's a great FM radio DJ voice. I'm Brian Karam. With us is Kurt Bardella. And Kurt, I guess the thing that I you know, we spoke at the beginning about country music. Who's your favorite? Who's your favorite artist?
Oh, my. Yeah, that's tough. Yeah, I love me some. I'll give you a handful, a very brief. Okay. I'm a big Brad Paisley. Love Eric Church is one of my favorites. I think Eric Church is probably the most passionate live performer I've ever seen in any format of music. Yeah, I think that, you know, Tim McGraw just has so many just classic timeless songs that have stood the test of time. And he does such an amazing job of putting out songs that that oftentimes speak to a moment that we're in. You know, and with Brad, you know, this guy's got 24 number one hits. And I call him the conscience of country music. He, you know, this is a guy who is out there right now publicly advocating for, you know, getting the vaccine. You know, just did an event with Dr. Jill Biden.
And, now, what and, a concept.
Yeah, right? You know, someone who has a song that everybody, you know, associates with him called American Saturday Night that is actually a song about immigration and America's diversity and champions America's diversity. He has been at the forefront of so many things culturally from country music and I think ahead of the curve on so many things. Song that they put out when Obama got elected called Welcome to the Future that he played for Obama in the White House, in the East Room of the White House. You know, oftentimes people associate country music, I think, with Republicans and conservatives, but, you know, to me...
Oh, I know plenty of liberal Democrats that are country music fans. That's a...
To me, the music, you know, is can stretch beyond that. And, you know, a lot of these artists just have something to say that connects in a much more universal way. And, you know, those and artists like Brad, Tim, and Eric really kind of speak that. Maren Morris, another
one. What about the old country music? You ever listen to any of the older stuff?
Well, I mean, like everybody in this format, it's like we all hear everything, you know, from Charlie Pride, obviously, who
Charlie Pride is great.
Recently passed away. You know, you know, old school Hank is always something that you love.
Hank Williams.
Yeah, senior, not junior. You know, yeah. George Strait, who's still going strong.
Mom, I mean, you got to get to Waylon and Willie and the boys.
Well, and I was going to actually say, like, there's this whole, what I call the Bakersfield boys, as someone who spent a little time in Bakersfield at one point in time professionally, you know, the Merle Haggard, Buck Owens.
Johnny Cash was, and.
You know, and you can't forget about the women, you know, Tammy Wynette, Loretta Lynn. Dolly, yeah. You know, I mean, you look at the real, it's so funny that country music gets labeled so conservative, but I'm like, the most progressive women in all of music, in my opinion, a lot of them came from that country format. When you look at.
Well, let's switch genres for a second and talk about rock. What do you like in rock and roll?
My favorite band of all time is the Eagles, actually.
Ah, I got a peaceful, easy feeling.
There you go. I'll never forget the
first. And how could you, so did you watch the Big Lebowski?
Of course, everyone's gone.
And I hate the fucking Eagles, man. How'd you watch that?
The first time I ever got to go to a concert at Madison Square Garden was 2014, and it was the Eagles.
Really?
Which I treasure now because obviously Glenn Frey would later go on and pass away. But they are my favorite band of all time. And I think one of the greatest concert experiences outside of them was actually in Nashville in 2015, seeing the Rolling Stones play LP Field.
Ah.
Just amazing.
So what was your first concert?
My first concert was a country concert. It was Eric Church and Jason Aldean.
Your first concert you ever went to outside of, you know, like going to a bar.
Oh, yeah. That was my first concert, Eric Church, Jason Aldean, 2010.
And what was your favorite concert experience?
Oh, man, that's tough. Eric Church at Madison Square Garden in 2014 was really special because I actually got to meet him through kind of a fluke of things that happened. I had sent an email to his manager, and this is just me as a fan at this point.
Right.
I wasn't in the business in any way. And I just said, hey, I heard Eric's playing MSG. Congratulations. I know why that's such a big deal. The backstory there was the last time he played that building was 7 years prior when he was opening for another act and he got fired from the tour that night because he played 30 minutes over. Ooh. Ironically, the person who replaced him on that tour was an unknown girl named Taylor Swift. Go figure.
Yeah, there you go.
So Eric headlining MSG was like, wow, that's really cool. After being fired from that tour in that building 7 years prior, you're headlining it. That's so awesome. And much to my shock, the manager, a guy named John Peets, wrote me back, said, there are two tickets at Will Call for you if you make it. I'm like, okay.
Oh hell yeah.
Right now. I like went to the train station like an hour later, like I'm going to the show. And sure enough, there was, when I picked up the tickets, the person who got them was like, you know, how did you get these tickets? Like, oh, guy named John Peets said, oh, you're one of John's people. Okay, come with us. Ended up in the bowels of Madison Square Garden. And they said, like, hey, Eric's going to come out in 5 minutes before he goes to stage. You should say hi to him. Like, okay, sure.
Yeah. And what's the biggest act you've ever seen?
Probably Garth.
Ah.
I've gotten to see Garth Brooks a handful of times now, but I remember seeing him for the first time live at a festival called Stagecoach in California with, you know, and this is like a 75,000 people are there.
Wow.
That was pretty magical. And although I don't know if anything will ever top what I just got to do on July 4th in Nashville, Tennessee, 350,000 people watching Brad Paisley, and being there for that was pretty special.
That's pretty cool. Now, one of the things I like to close out with, and this is an issue that has kind of picked up over the years, and originally it was a marginal issue, or at least it was derided. I remember that when people would ask about this in a briefing room, people would roll their eyes. But with the latest stuff from the DOD and with some of the videos, unidentified aerial phenomenon, UAP, which used to be called UFOs, have once again kind of caught the public's conscience. Have you ever seen anything you can't explain? And if you have, what was it? And if you haven't, do you believe in?
I haven't. I wish I did.
Yeah.
I think a couple of things are possibly going on here. Number one, I'm very much into the theory that it's actually us from the future.
Wow.
That makes sense to me. There's another theory that I buy into that it's actually kind of a multiverse situation where there's like a fluctuation and a little blip of something shines through. I have to believe that if there is other intelligent life out there, they've taken one look at us and go, they're not ready for us.
I think if there's intelligent life out there, they have to be more advanced than us. And they would look at us like we look at cockroaches. They're going, once they can prove they're not going to kill each other, maybe we'll talk to them.
Yeah,
otherwise, I'm not wasting my time.
If I'm an intelligent species out there, I'm looking at Earth right now. I'm like, okay, so let's get this straight. There is a pandemic killing all of you. You have the cure, but some of you refuse to take it. What?
That could be a whole nother podcast just on that, because I find it amazing that people still fight that. And that's, you know, I'm with you. If there's intelligent life out there, I don't think we divide ourselves. I think one of the scariest things that I see, there was a brief time during the 70s when I thought maybe we've turned the corner and maybe we're going to all, you know, like the Sly and the Family Stone song or Everyday People, you are me and I am you and all that crap. And then it quickly disintegrated. Today, it's we disparage people because of the color of their skin, the religion that they worship, whether or not they have any money, where they live, what flag they wrap themselves in. Any way we can divide ourselves, we do, and we simply ignore the things that are more important, that, you know, there's 7 billion of us on this planet and we're destroying the globe and we do nothing about it. So if I were an intelligent species, I would go, well, you know, let's give them about 50 years because they might destroy themselves and we could just move in.
I mean, you look at it, if you're another species out there, you're like, wait a second. So you guys have one planet and you're like ruining it. It's literally on fire half the time. Well, don't come anywhere near our galaxy. Shit. You guys are on your own.
You know, you still got some gold and some water and some land and some pretty trees. Well, just wait till you kill yourselves. And then, you know, we'll open it up as, you know, this will be where we go for vacation.
What I think would be hilarious is if it's actually in our future selves who are taking a class on a field trip to our time to show what a bunch of idiotic Neanderthals we were.
Well, that would be actually a hopeful sign to me that we have a future. I'm
exactly that's the optimistic version of
it. See, I'm concerned that we, you know, I have my first grandson, and my biggest concern is what will the world, and I look at the fights that we have politically, what kind of world is this poor kid going to inherit? Yeah. And I look at today, you know, those of us growing up, you know, I always, you know, my parents always said, look, we want you to do better than we did. And I have, but I'm concerned that my kids will be able to do better than I have, because it with all that's going on, boy, there's a hopeful note in there.
Well, I will say in a hopeful way, every generation that comes next, I have observed, is they are smarter, they are more diverse, they are more adaptable, they are more aware of the world that we are in than the one that came before. And as long as that continues to be the case, there's hope.
I think as long as there's Pickle Rick, there's hope.
Yeah.
There's my Rick and Morty plug for the day. Well, Kurt, it was absolutely a pleasure having you. I hope you come back sometime. It was I'd like to talk more about Republicans and Democrats going forward, especially going into the 2022 election cycle. I think we're starting that cycle soon.
Yeah, well, there'll be no shortage of things to talk about.
Yeah. Thanks for being with us. The show is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and thanks for listening.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.